Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Well, hey there, movie crushers. It's me, Noel. You might be a little surprised to hear me at the beginning of a Friday interview episode. But Chuck and I had the wonderful privilege of being able to sit down with John Cameron Mitchell from Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the creator and star of the Broadway show, very, very influential film and director of things like Short Bus and the incredible audio podcast, psychedelic adventure, Anthem Homunculus, which you can get on the Luminary Network. But Chuck had a family situation come up, and so I ended up flying solo with Chuck's blessing. So I met John last year through some podcast activities, and Hedwig was always a really, really important movie for me when I was younger in college, and I watched it many, many times. And so to get to meet him and not only meet kind of one of my film heroes, but also to have him be just the most lovely, down-to-earth, sweet man I've ever met in my entire life. And essentially, we kind of became pals. And he sat down with me, and we talked about his movie crush, Nashville, the Robert Altman epic kind of slice-of-life film that I had never seen. I'd really only seen Prairie Home Companion and MASH. So it was kind of, as we talk about in the interview, the beginning and the end of Altman's career, but hugely influential filmmaker, informed folks like Paul Thomas Anderson, this very naturalistic style of filmmaking. And we get into all that in the interview. So I won't bore you here at the top. Let's get into it.
I mean, I grew up with, you know, super sci-fi fantasy comic kid in the 70s, and you know, I was sort of an advanced student in Junction City, Kansas, where my podcast Anthem takes place. The nun didn't know what to do with me because I was too advanced in my studies, so she just put me, I had a class alone with the meanest nun in school.
Wow.
And she let me read whatever I want and then report on it. So I just read like Robert Heinlein and Dune and Andre Norton and wrote articles on it. She's like, there's no real literary value here. There's, you know, there's interesting descriptive language, but these types of books don't have literary value. And I was like, I was, you know, 14. I was like, they don't? You
know, I said, what was her concept of literary value? The Bible?
She wanted me to win. She was so mean. She wanted me to win a competition, English competition, which was basically all multiple choice. So if you had, you would, you know, Silas Marner, all the classics, you know, who's the protagonist of Silas Marner? Who wrote, you know, Little Women? Who wrote, you know, As I Lay Dying?
So trivia.
But I never had to read the books.
Right. Well, yeah.
I got first in Kansas in these, you know, like knowing the titles and the protagonists and the writers, but never read one of those books. And she was like, yes! She was like this very competitive nun who was like, we've destroyed the competition and never read a book.
Now, there's a character in your podcast that you talk about, Anthem Homunculus, that's a nun who I believe is your aunt.
Based on my Aunt Terry, who is the coolest relative and aunt and nun, who is like super liberal and, you know, environmentalist. And
right. Not a heroin addict, though, like the Patti LuPone character.
No, she wasn't a heroin addict. Okay. She was a little embarrassed by that. But I'm going to see her next week when I sing Brian Weller in my song, I See What I Am, which was Patti LuPone's big song, with the Jazz Orchestra of Lincoln Center and Wynton Marsalis.
Oh, my gosh. That's a big deal.
Oh, come on.
Next week, you say?
Well, it's the last 2 days of January, first day of February.
Okay. I'm in town next week. Maybe I can make that happen. I would love that. Just backing up to Anthem, and you know, you say it's set in
your hometown
of Junction City, Kansas.
Junction City. What was that like? Like, in, you know, I know what it was like as it was portrayed in the podcast. What was that like for you, aside from these solo classes with Sister
Anne?
Yeah.
Or Sister Frederick. No, she was the headmistress.
Got it.
They had to take those male names. There was a sense of, you know, it was the 70s, so you didn't really know what was happening outside the world. And, you know, punk was exploding elsewhere, and we didn't know what that was. And the Cars were the, you know, seemed the punkiest thing we'd ever heard of. We get stoned listening.
That was on the radio, though, right?
Cars were on the radio, yeah. And they were new, right? They were the first new wave hits, I guess, in the U.S. So we get stoned and listen to Moving in Stereo at Milford Lake. And didn't know that there was a town under the lake because they had flooded, you know, when they flood a town to make a reservoir. And that became an image in our podcast. And so it was going back there and remembering the weirdness of this small, high-crime town next to an army base, Fort Riley, which meant it was very racially mixed, which made it more fun. But it was still Kansas, and it was still kind of conservative. And, you know, my school, St. Pius, there was like 15 graduating students. And, you know, I went to the reunion, the 35th reunion recently.
St. Pius is the most conservative saint.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was Saint Xavier. St. Pius was in Albuquerque where I went. But he was a super conservative pope. But St. X was more easygoing. But it was always really... It had this, because of the army thing, it was like super racially mixed, and there was all kinds of music was valid, and people didn't separate themselves as much. So I went to my high school reunion only once, 35th anniversary. So I recommend, if you hate the idea of a reunion, go after you're 50, because everyone's evened out. You're not competitive anymore because you're alive.
Right.
Right. You're just like
the
same.
Great equalizer.
It's a great equalizer is time. And it was beautiful. And I was just remembering, you know, and like looking at the trailer park where Hedwig would have lived. And in Anthem, the character lives in Hedwig's trailer, though has never met her. So it's all in the same universe. And Brian Weller and I wrote the first draft in Lawrence, Kansas, which was in William Burroughs' house. Mm-hmm. Because I knocked on the door on that first trip, and the caretaker, Tom King, was like, "What?" I was like, "I'm writing a musical that might take place on this porch." He's like, "All right, I have
another one.
Come on in. Yeah. Here's the bullet holes that Bill shot off from his bath into the roof." And it was like, wow, William Burroughs' tiny house, big yard, and we wrote there for about a month. James Grauerholtz, his partner, invited us. And so the insanity of Burroughs, which really predicted the insanity of today, you know, if ever there was a Trump character or ever there was a Burroughs character, it would be Trump, right? Just beyond belief, right?
Absolutely.
Proto-fascist, you know, Burroughs was right. And,
cartoonish, even, you know?
Cartoonish, yeah. But, you know, truly beyond belief. And so it was a perfect place to set it and to start it. And we kind of did a road trip writing a tour of it.
And Burroughs features relatively prominently into the show itself. There's a fantastic sound-alike or a voice performance that really hits Burroughs on the nose.
Yeah, Ben Foster, who actually played him in Kill Your Darlings, the movie, and wants to make a film that he's directing himself as Burroughs in the prime years in Mexico, and, you know, when he shot his wife by accident. And
That was one of my. I love the whole thing, and just I got the.
That's a particularly fun section.
It's very fun, but I got the privilege to actually sit and experience this podcast in one sitting, in New York, at the IFC Center, where you did a listening party. That was the first for me for a listening party of an entire narrative podcast series, and that's really the way to experience a show like that.
Something that dense, so you can really focus the sound. The 5.1 cinema mix. We had some abstract visuals we created for it that I think really worked.
Distributed CBD gummies and soft blankets and lavender face mists. So the whole thing was just a delight.
Going close, spritzing them in your face.
Uh-huh, with her little dog, Pee-Pee, right? Did I make that up?
Pip? Yes.
Okay.
Brian Weller's in the room. Say hi, Brian.
Hello.
My brilliant composer.
Brilliant composer.
We're doing more of these marathons. We did one in Austin.
Yeah, anyone that has a chance, that if one of these comes through your town, check it out. And if not, get your Luminary subscription and check it out. It's a really, really wonderful show. So big time influenced by your early days growing up in a small town and kind of how that informed the rest of your career. I really think it's interesting. You think of a place like a small town in Kansas, you don't think of it as being particularly progressive, but I love this idea of you kind of making your own culture and having access to things, but obviously there's no internet. You're not able to find the latest things. You kind of get it in little dribs and drabs, right? So what was that like? And when did you kind of break through beyond just the cars on the radio? And were there zines? Like, what was it?
I was still, a good boy, Catholic boy, son of a general, queer, hadn't quite dealt with it, but knew I would. I think being queer saved me from an unexamined life. I'd probably be more like the character, in Anthem, a librarian, still creative, but just maybe not taking as many risks. So I really put down being queer to forcing me to examine everything that I've been taught. If certain things I was taught were clearly wrong, then others must have been wrong too. Mm-hmm. So that's...
Well, it's like when you find out Santa Claus isn't real. It's like, does that mean Jesus isn't real too? Or there is no God? Exactly. It's like a leap that you make.
Here's a funny story. A friend of mine was... his parents were kind of hippies and they sort of did a Santa thing. Sure, Santa. He was six and they were like, yes, Santa. But they were very casual about it and they'd keep forgetting the plot and they kind of let it slip, when he was six that, they're like, right, Santa. And he's like, what? There's no Santa? And they were like, oh, well, no, but the spirit of giving. And he's like, he was furious at six and he went up to his room and he didn't speak to them for 2 days. And then he came back from school and they're like, hi. And he goes, hi. How was today? Fine. I have a new friend, Nathan. Oh, great. That's great. I'm going up to my room. So every day they had to apologize for the Santa. Next day, you're a little late today. Where were you? I was playing with Nathan. Oh, Nathan, your new friend. We'd love to meet him. Yeah. Went up the next day. I'm going to stay a sleepover with Nathan tonight. You are not. We need to meet Nathan and his parents. And he goes, there is no Nathan.
Only Zool.
And they were just...
Wow. Wow. Sex. That's Oh my gosh.
He set the whole thing. There is no Nathan. How does it feel?
That is an extreme reaction to finding out that Santa Claus isn't real. I actually had a really great conversation with your friend Julian Coster. He introduced me to. We're actually sitting here in Athens, Georgia right now, by the way. Julian of Neutral Milk Hotel. You've got a lot of Athens connections, as do I. But Julian really, really loves the idea of Santa Claus and Christmas.
Yes.
It's a big thing for him.
There's some Santa stuff here from we're at Robbie Cucharo's house, who's in Julian's band, The Music Tapes, and Orbiting Human Circus, his podcast.
And I asked Julian, you don't think it's the great betrayal when you find out your parents have been lying to you and that Santa's not real? And he goes, no. Santa is real. Santa is a spirit. It isn't just because he's not a person that comes down your chimney doesn't mean he's not real. And he loves this idea of the spirit of Christmas, of giving and kindness and charity and all that. And it really made me take a step back and kind of ditch that cynical view.
Yeah.
Because
there's a sculpture up there of Santa with the halo and wings.
Yep.
I mean, he was a saint.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that's a really interesting, the two diametrically opposing stories about finding out that Santa's not real. But I'm a dad and my kid's 11 and she took it just fine. She kind of knew.
She's like,
and,
I know.
You know, I was worried that she was going to go down that rabbit hole of, well, if Santa's not real, are you lying to me about literally everything?
But we've
moved past that. So I like the idea of Anthem and Hedvig having this kind of shared universe. You don't really lean into that too hard in the podcast. But tell me a little bit about the genesis of the Hedvig character and the whole way that came about for you.
Hedvig. Well, Hedvig was based on a babysitter for our family who was, I realized later, was a prostitute on the side. And me and my friend Brenda would go to her trailer park and sing songs for her, and she had a lot of dates and never knew what they were going to look like before they came over. And she was like, she's so popular and she's not even that good looking, and she's just so, and if they came up the driveway, we had to go out the back, but sometimes if she didn't like the look of them, she'd go out the back too with us. So she kind of was the initial visual and kind of, you know, tone for the character. And then Stephen Trask and I added a lot more, you know, to her. And we were both, he was working and I was hanging out at a rock and roll drag club called Squeeze Box in the 90s at Don Hills. And it was the queer club I always wanted because it was just so punk and fun. And he said we should develop the musical we were writing. We should start with this female character who was a smaller character in the piece, Helga, mm-hmm. who became Hedvig. And I just thought about her more and more. And then the idea of the forced sex change and the Berlin stuff. My dad lived in Berlin for a while as a military commander. So all this stuff came together, and watching the amazing performers, you know, Jane County and Mistress Formica and Laverne Cox and these people who were performing there, these trans and drag performers who just blew me away. They were so punk and didn't even know it, you know. And our first gig was so exciting, and our first song was Origin of Love that he wrote.
It's my favorite.
And it was the birth of it. And we tried to keep it out of theaters for a while to keep it from getting toned down, you know, by a theater and keep it in the clubs.
So you did it as a band almost first?
We did it as gigs for a fake band. And
but it didn't have all the narrative pieces yet?
It
or?
Did. Okay. Even the first gig had a narrative story, and I ripped the drag off at the end like I do in the show. Sure. But we covered, we used cover songs for the songs we didn't have. So the song about the operation, we used Yoko Ono's Death of Samantha. And for another song, we used Oh Well, Fleetwood Mac was our opening song. Boys Keep Swinging.
Love that one.
Half Breed. So it was like we rewrote the lyrics. Reckless Eric, Whole Wide World was sort of about trying to, you know, get out of mm-hmm. Berlin.
Did you find that you ended up taking cues from some of those stylistically for the songs that you replaced them with?
Yeah, like... Yeah. This is a song we have called Exquisite Corpse, which is a real Pear Ubu-like song. So we used to do Nine Alignment Pact. Hedvig had a Serbian boyfriend who was a DJ, and she could pick up a show on her braces. So we had weird Pear Ubu-type songs, and, you know, she was from East Berlin and wanted to be Nine Alignment Pact. You know, that was a song. And so all the people that we were learning from informed the music and the story, and that's why it's quite eclectic style-wise. I mean, this all kind of has that 70s, you know, crunchy feeling, but sure. There's country, there's, you know, there's ballads.
But the character has that chameleonic quality as well, like with the looks
she's
and with
a
the different wigs. And exactly.
Yeah. And Anthem really followed on from that. It perhaps has a similar tone, you know, someone's talking to an audience, telling stories through songs, humor, you know, there's a similar tone to Hedvig. We wrote Anthem originally as a Hedvig sequel, but that was too much. And Then it became more autobiographical. What would I be like if I never left Junction City and holed up in there and got sick and had to crowdfund my treatment? So, we're still doing more of these marathons. We've got some coming up in Portland, L.A., and San Francisco, yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, if one comes through your town, I highly recommend checking it out. I'd love to pivot to Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
I had never seen this particular Altman movie, and I'm not really a student of Altman. I've honestly only seen MASH and A Prairie Home Companion, which is kind of embarrassing.
That's like the beginning and the end.
It is, right? And the funny thing is, Nashville and Prairie Home Companion actually have a little bit in common in some ways. Only because Prairie Home takes place behind the scenes in this big theater show.
Right.
And you kind of see all the lives of the different characters, the singers and their dressing rooms and all of that. And then everyone comes together in the end for the big show, right? That's sort of what Nashville is. There's all of these disparate characters in the city of Nashville going through their lives. I read Ebert wrote of it that you sort of are just plopped into this world where people don't make entrances as much as they just kind of exist. And that's what I think was so special about it. I watched it with my girlfriend and I walked away from it. And we were both kind of like, what is this movie about? And that's sort of the point. We could get into what it's about, but
yeah, I know what it's about.
I think that's exactly. It's open ended. You can absolutely project yourself onto it, but it really is just like slice of life is such a cliche thing to say, but that's really what it feels like. It feels like you're living with these real people, these real characters, and I just was fascinated by it. It's this massive ensemble cast.
Massive widescreen.
Exactly. And like I think there's something like 25 speaking roles, but there's no star. There's no perspective character that is taking you on this journey. It's all of these things that then come together at the end for this big benefit concert at the end at the Parthenon, right, in Nashville. This is what Ebert wrote about this film. Robert Altman's Nashville, which was the best American movie since Bonnie and Clyde, creates in the relationships of nearly two dozen characters a microcosm of who we were and what we were up to in the 1970s. It's a film about the losers and the winners, the drifters and the stars in Nashville, and the most complete expression yet of not only the genius, but also the humanity of Altman, who sees people with his camera in such a way as to enlarge our own experience. That's like vintage Ebert from when it came out. So why Nashville?
I saw it first in college in the early 80s at the giant Varsity Movie Palace in Evanston, Illinois. And, there were certain films that just intoxicated me. That was the one that I remember the most. It's long. You feel like you've lived it. You come out of it feeling kind of stoned. It's incredibly funny and incredibly moving at the same time. And that's a nexus that I love to work in, is that place of, am I going to laugh or am I going to cry? And just the audacity of, taking your time. Mm-hmm. I mean, even, today it's even more shocking to actually take your time.
Yeah, there's no frenetic editing in this. You live it, everything breathes. Yeah, exactly.
A lot of scenes are in one shot that zoom slowly. That's a classic Altman thing to do, is to zoom very slowly and focus. He pioneered multi-track recording. So he would have, body mics on dozens of people in one scene, and the actors never knew the camera was on them because the camera was so far away doing these long zooms on long lenses. So you got a real sense of reality when he wouldn't tell people who was being shot, so they all were on it. They were all acting fully and improvising a lot,
right,
with a very strong central script by Joan Tewksbury, who I even wrote a fan letter to back in the 80s when I was starting out. I sent her my first script and a cassette tape of the soundtrack of the song.
Which is amazing, and it's a character in and of itself. The songs,
yeah, right. But my script was...
Oh. Gotcha.
Because it had a feeling of Nashville, and it was pre-existing songs, but I She wrote back, "I'm not going to have time to read your script, but I'd like to keep the cassette to listen to." And I was like,
"At least she wrote back. That's pretty rare. That's nice."
I almost met her recently in New York. I was going to like, "I want my cassette back." And so when I saw it, I was sitting alone and I just was drunk. You know, being an act, studying acting in Northwestern, it was just, Altman is such a lover of actors and demands them to be partners. Other directors, Kubrick and other geniuses, use them as puppets, brilliant puppets, but it was all about Kubrick. Altman, I think, had this theatrical feeling of like, we're all doing this together. And he famously had the actors at the end of the day, the shooting day, watch the dailies from the day before and have drinks and get stoned and whatever. It was mates for a long day because you're shooting for 12 hours and then you're looking at the dailies. And it was like this party. You know, all the actors who worked with him said it was just like being in a party. And the movie executives hated him because he was so, you know, like, fuck you, I'm doing it my way, like Cassavetes.
Well, he'd earned his stripes at this point with the hit, right? Like with MASH.
Yeah, which was a weird, you know, film that it only happened because they were doing something else and they let him do it without checking in on it. So when it came—
Like they forgot?
Yeah, when it came to them, they were like, what the hell is this? Because it was really very loose.
Sure.
You know, it was closer to Easy Rider than anything else. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise hit. You know, it caught— he was an older generation, you know, more from the beatnik era.
Right. But it caught the zeitgeist in an unexpected
way. Of the
way,
hippies,
maybe.
Yeah. You know, which he wasn't, but he got with them. You know, he's like, they loved him because he was a true man of the people and a true anti-authoritarian.
Sure.
And, you know, even the weird kind of gays thing in because remember they sort of pretend or they tell one of the characters that he's gay to fuck with him, and then they have like this sort of living funeral for him, and it's like a very strange— he's going to kill himself for being gay, but it's sort of a joke.
It's weird too. Like, I mean, even the theme, the suicide is painless.
That was the song,
right? But what a strange sentiment.
I know, and it was a Korean War, but obviously about Vietnam.
Sure.
So Nashville, to me, was his chef d'oeuvre. You know, that was his great— he made some great films, but to me, that's his best. And the actors— he could also take any actor, excuse me, he could take any actor, it wasn't even an actor, you know, like Lily Tomlin was just more of a sketch comedian. And he gave her this role that was quite low-key, and she was brilliant. You know, was nominated for an Oscar and maybe won. And Keith Carradine, who was like the, you know, the L.A. kind of folky—
cool guy.
Yeah, the cool guy who was somewhat country but really more like the Eagles or something. And he was fucking everybody inside. And the amazing scene where he sings "I'm Easy" to all these women who think he's singing to them directly. Right. And then you find out it's Lily Tomlin and Ned Beatty, and it's just— and the stripper Gwen Wells, a heartbreaking scene of these people trying to make it. And
let's go into that a little bit. I mean, to me, this is post Watergate. There's a political vibe.
Just, yeah, I just think he was making only, it. Yeah, during—
I think that's right. But there's this character who sort of looms large over the whole thing. This faceless presidential primary candidate,
right, kind of a Ross Perot type.
Exactly. And what's the name of the character? H. Philip Walker, I believe.
Yeah. And I think was a real guy.
Maybe so. I don't know that. But all you ever— you hear from this character because his campaign bus has these megaphones. And you just hear him pontificating, whether it's him in live or it's recordings, you don't know, it doesn't really matter. But it's all about how politicians are corrupt, they're all lawyers, they're all a bunch of crooks, you know, all of that stuff. So there's that vibe. And then you're in Nashville, but it's very clear there's hippies in it. Jeff Goldblum plays this amazing— I refer to him as the magical hippie because he doesn't speak, and he does this magic trick at the beginning where he like pours salt into his hand and then like pulls it out of the air. And
Shelley Duvall.
Super, right. Shelley Duvall. super skinny hippie kind of groupie character who's only in town to see her dying aunt, but never manages to make it to see her in the hospital.
Right, she's a selfish creature,
and she keeps getting distracted by celebrity and chasing guys.
And her uncle's played by Keenan Wynn, is it?
I think so. Yeah,
who's touching. You know, his wife has just died, and he's in the hospital, and he's trying to reach out to people nearby.
That's
and
right.
It's a beautifully interwoven story. Someone feels like kind of like a tapestry or the loom that makes a tapestry, because you see the characters winding in and out of each other, bumping into each other. You know, there's the African-American country singer based on Charlie Pride, right. Henry Gibson.
Who I love, by the way. He's maybe my favorite.
Oh, he's like this horrible, old school kind of racist, power broker.
He's kind of the old guard, though. He's the first guy you see in the movie where they're making this bicentennial song in the studio live to tape, which is super cool because you see the background singers in one booth and the band, and he yells at the hippie piano player
with the long
and says,
hair.
Get a haircut, you don't belong in Nashville. So he's kind of the old guard. Then you've got Keith Carradine, who's sort of this like more hippie type folk singer. He's kind of the new guard, and there's this interesting clash. Like, Nashville is this microcosm of what's going on with that clash between old and new. And I think a big part of it too is sort of the banality of evil in the entertainment industry, where people are sort of treated like pawns. Even Barbara, the kind of ailing country singer,
Ronnie Blakely.
Yes, what's her character's name? It's Barbara Jean. Right,
she's amazing.
She's incredible. But like, from the moment you see her, you know she's not well, and yet she's like kind of propped up and pushed out on stage, and you barely even get to hear her sing. And there's a part where she is performing and is clearly having some kind of episode, and she's like talking about her grandma and all this stuff, and her manager or whatever kind of pulls her off, and she's like, "No, I'm not done," but it's very clear that she's become a liability.
The club I did Hedwig in, this drag queen named Sherry Vine, who I love, did a recreation of that scene where Barbara Jean is starting a song and then like digressing and like, I used to live on a farm and the chickens were and just kind of going insane.
Right.
And the song starts and then stops and starts. But she's doing like Hearts, Crazy on You, I think was the song she did. But only a couple of us recognize what she was actually doing from...
But then she has this nemesis who's like the more gussied up version of her, kind of
Karen
who's
Black,
more than willing to swoop in and capitalize on her, not doing very well.
Connie White, played by Karen Black.
Exactly. Oh, funny.
And the other great thing is that Altman asked each actor to write their own songs.
Right.
So Karen Black wrote her own song, like a Rolling Stone. Uh-huh. And Ronnie Blakely, who was a country singer from Montana, I think, or Idaho, hadn't really acted. And she's brilliant. Again, nominated for an Oscar. She has incredible breakdown scenes. Alan Garfield, her horrible manager.
Yeah.
Again, propping her up. She's sort of a Loretta Lynn type, but falling apart. My favorite song is probably Dues, one of her songs.
Sure.
But Keith Carradine wrote I'm Easy, which won an Oscar. Everyone wrote their own songs, which you can feel it.
Oh, 100%.
And sang them all live, which was also very new.
And rare, yeah, for sure. That Keith Carradine song, winning that Oscar, got him a record deal.
Oh, really?
And then he went on and made a couple of records for Asylum, but it wasn't just a flash in the pan kind of like, vanity project. Like, he obviously had some chops. He was a good singer, good songwriter. Mm. I have that record and it's quite good. You mentioned the scene with the stripper, who I actually didn't realize was a stripper until a little later in the movie. I just thought she was kind of a wannabe because she's a pretty bad singer.
Well, she was a wannabe. They forced her to strip, remember?
For sure. But I realized there's a conversation she has at the end where I almost feel like she's meant to be a sex worker, because she's talking to a guy who seems like he's maybe her pimp, and he's saying, "Honey, you're a bad singer. Like, let it go. Give it up," And she just is so plucky and like full of confidence that she doesn't see it. But that scene, to me, the way women are treated in this film seems very intentional on Altman's part, to be like, they're if they can't sing or they're not sexualized, then they're like marginalized. And even Lily Tomlin's character, who's kind of, I would say, the moral center of the film, because she has deaf children and she's obviously a really devout mother. She is a gospel singer, so I think that's not unintentional.
Terrible gospel singer.
Right. But she really sells it, you know, and gives it her all. And there's that scene when Keith Carradine sings I'm Easy and they kind of lock eyes. And I'm like, why is she so into this guy? He's kind of the heel. Like, he's a womanizer and he's sleeping with people and then calling up the next woman that he's going to sleep with, you know, from the room. And then, oh my God, she went to bed with him. I didn't understand. That seemed like it was meant to imply that no one's beyond corruption, you know, in this world. I don't know.
It's a beautiful world. And he has his work, his repertory company of actors that you see in many of his films, Frederick Forrest and Ned Beatty, and even Julie Christie shows up, and Elliot Gould.
Right. Is that hilarious? As himself?
Yeah. It's a hilarious scene where he shows up, and Geraldine Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin's daughter, who is also a kind of a narrator. She's like a BBC, you know.
Oh, I love her.
Ridiculous BBC journalist.
Right. There's a scene where she's walking through like a scrapyard and saying the rust on the cars look like dried blood, or so, you know, it's just so over the top.
Yeah. It's so juicy and delicious. It must have been a blast to shoot. And it has a kind of, when you talked about what is it about? I mean, to me, it all comes down to that last scene when Barbara Jean is doing the fundraiser, and a character that has been sort of shadowy,
with the guitar case,
turns out to be a killer,
right?
You know, and a stalker, and she is assassinated. You know, it's not a spoiler. I mean, it's very much leading up to this. And then the plucky wannabe, played by Barbara Harris.
Not a different one, who kind of you see try to get backstage and she's held up. And
yeah, Barbara Harris, who's a great, you know, 70s star who just recently died, plays a minimally talented, you know, country singer. And she, you know, as Barbara Jean goes down, they're like, keep the music going, so there's no panic. And she grabs the mic and sings the song, which is the center of, metaphorically, of the whole piece, which is, you know, the chorus is, you may say that I ain't free, but it don't worry me. And that is America.
Right.
You know, we scream about this freedom and it changes meaning. You know, conservatives will say, you're not free unless your healthcare is taken away from you. You know, are you, you know, the definition of freedom is so malleable in our country that, you know, plutocrats use it to keep people under. You know, it's like, you're not free if you actually get anything. If you get free education, you're not free. And, you know, it's like, but we also were based on a kind of freedom. So other things came out of America that were very useful to the world. You know, ideas of female emancipation and queer rights and, you know, finding civil rights came out of this crazy stew. You know, a country founded by capitalist conquistadors and religious fanatics, you know, who pushed the native people out, crushed it, brought in slaves, and then weirdly created a place that was a beacon for other countries of self-determination.
Right.
You know, it's a weird
kind of contradiction.
Yeah, almost. We're a strange country. And I feel that film captures so much of it.
But effortlessly. It doesn't, it's not cloying in any kind of metaphor. You know, it's, you have to kind of bring that to it yourself. And I knew there was something to it, and I read a little more about it and realized I was on the right track. But it's more of a feeling than some sort of lesson.
Yeah.
That's what I think is so special about
it. Yeah, it's like, it's really, you feel like you've lived it rather than been told anything. Mm-hmm. You know, a subtle moment of, you know, the black country singer based on Charlie Pride.
At the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah. And then he's at the racetrack or something, and Henry Gibson's like, oh, how great to see you. And then under his breath, he goes, you know, you're lucky to be alive here. Whoa. You know, and it's like, it's just like the that other, you know, the darkness under the southern, right. the southern
under
skin.
The rhinestones.
Yeah, you know, under the yeah. hospitality. And, but also very loving. Of course, Nashville itself hated the movie once again. Of course, they were just like, how dare you, you know,
outsider.
Satirize yeah. us, you yeah. know, you damn California people.
It, that's the thing, though. It doesn't even strike me as satirical. It strikes me as very real.
And it feels very tender. You know, uh-huh. I don't think of it as making fun of these people.
I don't think so either.
You know, it's definitely has satirical elements and crazy, you know, madness about it. But you love everybody, mm-hmm. you know.
In one way or another, for
yeah.
sure. Yeah. It's interesting, too, the kind of wannabe that sings that last song. I found her delivery to almost have this unhinged kind of more punk rock mm. modern quality mm-hmm. when a lot of the vocals had been very smooth. Old school and smooth mm-hmm. and like that kind of real traditional country western style. She almost brought more of like a belty kind of like rawness to it
yeah.
that I thought was on purpose. I really did yeah. think, you know, because it was like, this is the future. You know, I don't know.
Yeah,
again,
yeah.
she was an opportunist, obviously.
And
but
she was a, you know, a Broadway singer mm-hmm. herself.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something very weird about that, the way she sings it, and it's...
And then it just ends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredible. The soundtrack is, like you said, is an amazing thing in and of itself, because so much of it is sung live, and... somehow it was a hit. Pauline Kael, you know, kind of saved it. You know, she was so influential, and the studio, I believe, was going wanted to cut the hell out of it because it's 3 hours long. And Altman slipped her or screened her his cut, so she reviewed it before it came out.
Oh wow!
And in effect, stopped the studio from cutting it.
Interesting. She was that influential.
Yeah, that influential. Imagine like giving it to a critic before it comes. I mean, the studio was furious,
oh, yeah.
but it made it a huge hit too.
Smart on Altman's part. He kind of knew what he had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my favorite filmmakers of the 70s were Altman, Cassavetes, Hal Ashby, and Kubrick. Mm-hmm. And they all drove everybody crazy, you know, in the business. But of course, the actors and his collaborators loved them.
I don't know if people love Kubrick, the actors.
Shelley Duvall had problems with him.
Well, he just infamously made people do 9,000 takes.
And, yeah,
whereas Altman, they're talking about it's a party because it all feels very true to life, and
yeah,
you know, everyone's
and there
mic'd
weren't
up.
That many takes, yeah.
right?
Yeah, I think you're right. Kubrick was, but he drove you know the powers that be crazy,
oh, for sure.
of course. But and they often wrote. You know, they often made very idiosyncratic films that were long and, you know, didn't fit into the realm of, you know, marketing. And but, you know, among my top films, they came from that era, you know, and there was Woman Under the Influence, which was Cassavetes, great film. Being There, you know, was...
Favorite. I know that was going to be one of your picks. We
yeah,
actually,
about that.
Somebody else just did that one.
Oh, did they? Yeah.
yeah
Such so. An undersung film. Of course, he did Harold and Maude and Shampoo 2 and mm-hmm. Last Detail, which I love. And Kubrick's, you know, wonderful, you know, very strange, amoral panoply of films. I think maybe Dr. Strangelove is my favorite. I love Lolita, too. That doesn't get a lot of love, but I think that's great. And Cassavetes, who went his own way and inspired all of them, you know, because he got started in the 50s as some people describe him as, you know, the beginning of independent filmmaking. In this country, he was inspired by the New Wave and Shadows and Faces and eventually his great films, Woman Under the Influence and Opening Night. Were ones that I keep coming back to. Say, how the hell did he do that? You know, and a lot of it has to do with working with the same people, you know, keeping people off balance,
sure.
but in a safe way, you know, to get some the most surprising performances. And
Have you seen Uncut Gems yet?
Yes.
The Safdie brothers have a similar thing where they kind of just let mm-hmm. their actors go. Mm. They don't, I saw an interview on a podcast where they say they don't yell cut in action.
Yeah.
They just kind of set the pieces in motion and then let them go.
Yeah.
And the actors know when to start. And there's so much, again, like with Altman, stuff going on top of itself, like in the gem shop where there's mm-hmm. so much real hubbub and excitement and people talking over each other. And that to me really reminded me of the Altman. And clearly Altman was a huge influence on Paul Thomas Anderson and Magnolia in particular.
In fact, when Altman was ailing, Paul helped direct his last, helped direct a little bit on Prairie Home.
That's right. I remember that.
But I love Paul's work too, and the way he works with actors. And so I learned from all of them when I was making my films. You know, I was, you know, I at the Sundance Lab, I broke down that scene with Lily Tomlin and I'm Easy, that song, broke it down into storyboards. That was part of, you know, training to direct Hedvig. Breaking down a scene that you love and seeing how the pieces work is a really great exercise. And the way they both worked with actors, I did work my own version of a mixture of improv paraphrasing and a set verbatim script, which I used most in my film Short Bus.
Right.
Which has
a lot of non-actors as well, right?
Or less experienced actors. Sure. And, you know, Short Bus has a bit of a Nashville feeling. You know, there's multiple protagonists mm-hmm. and who bump into each other and all periodically an event brings them together. You know, in Nashville, there's three events where all the characters are in the same space, whether they know each other or not. So beginning when they're all arriving in the airport, there's the traffic jam from the airport, which is a hilarious situation where they're all stuck in a crash on an interstate, and they all just start making music and drinking and whatever. And then the end, which is the big benefit concert when they all converge. So with Short Bus, I did the same. You know, there's a salon where they all come. There's the blackout, New York City blackout, when they all come back together at the end. So these acts of God or goddess, you know, forces them all to come together and find what they have in common. So those films were very, Harold and Maude as well, were very influential on my three films, Hedvig, Short Bus, and How to Talk to Girls at Parties. Rabbit Hole was a more traditional thing, but even the way I work with the actors was similar. You know, with my films, I would write the scenes very clearly, but with Short Bus, I'd say you can never learn your lines. I'll fire you if you learn your lines. So if there were 10 lines in a scene and after the fifth line, someone pours a glass of water, they still had to do 10 lines, but every take we did, they had to do those lines differently. They had to paraphrase them. You know, with less experienced actors, the danger is always that they lose it after a take or two because they're trying to recreate something. But if they can do it differently every time, there's always a flow. They still, for editing's sake, have to, after that fifth line, pour the water or leave at the certain point. So that helps the editing.
Yeah.
But, and often we'd use two cameras. And so I learned a lot of that from Altman.
Well, John, I could talk movies with you for hours, but alas, I think we should wrap this up. But we've been doing a thing. Actually, I think Chuck stopped doing it, but I'm going to do it with you to wrap this one up. We ask our guests what their movie-going rituals are. I know you're a movie fanatic. What's your theater in New York?
Well, we have a lot of great theaters in New York, which is, you know, within, you know, spitting distances, Film Forum, the Quad, the Metrograph, you know, even Lincoln Center. There's just IFC Center. There's just a million. Mm-hmm. And some things you do need to see in a theater. I watch a lot at home on my giant TV and, you know, good sound system. So I love having movie nights too. And Those are always fun to get the kookier ones. Like recently we watched a crazy film called Slither. You heard of that?
It's like a horror sci-fi thing?
No.
Okay.
James Caan, Sally Kellerman. It was like a strange little road comedy from the 70s.
There's another one from more recently called
Slither.
Yeah,
there's another Slither. Yeah. Horror sci-fi. And there's also
Right.
Which is another film. But it's a weird oddball. It's just so fun. And some things you just need to see in the screen because they require that. Nashville is one, I think, because it's such wide frames. You it's great. You want to see it on a big, giant screen.
Metrograph is a place that I've been really wanting to go. And, Brian and I actually tried to go, but I forget in New York for the kind of limited run, stuff like that, it sells out. It's a thing.
Yeah, it's a small theater.
Yeah, for sure.
I saw, one of the... After Nashville, he did try to do similar films with multiple casts.
Shortcuts people love, right?
Shortcuts is great. A Wedding is another one that people don't think about much that I really like. It doesn't quite have the depth of Nashville, but it's incredible, similar comic madness in A Crazy Wedding. Carol Burnett is great in it. My favorite line from that is she's like having an illicit affair at the wedding and the other married person is like, Carol or whatever her name is, Carol, will you have an affair with me? Will you actually, she's like trying not to throw up and it's all very new for her. And he goes, Carol, what's your answer right now? Your mouth is the most important opening in your body for me. I always remember that line. Also, Health, which is a disaster. That's maybe his worst film, which is at a health food convention. Dick Cavett's in it.
Oh, wow.
I think Carol Burnett's
in it. Is it a fun disaster?
It's just not funny. But okay. I saw a print of it. Who did? Ronald Reagan hated Health. He also said ketchup was a vegetable for school lunches.
I think our current president might think that as well.
Yeah, let's not talk about him. But I did see at Metrograph a print of Health, which is very hard to find. And it was like, it's kind of cool. And prints, they start to go.
Sure.
They get to go bad and they become pink.
Okay.
That's when you know it's an old print. It's like it's very thin and everything's pink,
right.
So it's kind of cool.
I saw a print of Bad Lieutenant with Harvey Keitel at the Nighthawk in Brooklyn, which I really like a lot. And that movie's from the 90s, but the quality of what New York looked like in the 90s, first of all, plus the wear on the print, made it look like it was shot in the 70s.
Yeah.
The whole vibe of it was very 70s.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Abel Ferrara, I believe, right?
Mad Men.
Where do you like to sit in the theater? What's your, given your druthers, are you a
if back? If it's a foreign film, I'll actually go very close because I like to slump down when I'm watching and then the subtitles, if there's somebody's head there. Film Forum has these really long theaters, which I don't like the length of them, but I'll have to go up really close. The screen is small there, so if you go up close, it feels like you're at the Ziegfeld. If it's a bigger place with a nice rake to the seating, I'll just sit, in that first row with a lateral aisle.
Sure.
So you don't have anyone in front of you. I just don't like anyone in front of me. And I like to put my feet up too.
Are you a snacker?
No, because I don't like the crunching and the... My own what? I brought my own fiber pills or something, but... who decided that popcorn...
You resent the rustling. You resent
who decided that popcorn was the thing in a theater? It's the loudest food.
Not only that, it is an insidious food, John, because it gets stuck in your teeth in the worst possible way. It's not even that satisfying. I don't know whose idea that was. I think it was a byproduct of the corn industry. Like, we need to figure out a new way to sell this stuff,
Well, it's it's the anti-carb time and it's a lot of fiber.
Please, yeah. Please.
Someone in a theater who worked there in Portland, he told me, and I agree, that if the screen of whatever theater you're in were to fall towards the audience, you would want to be in the row that is right, like one behind where the top of it would be. That's the perfect place to sit.
That would be the best vantage point to view this disaster, is what you're saying. I got it. Oh, I see. But still, you know, it would also, you would just miss the disastrous falling of the screen. Yeah.
There was a
I love that.
I think at Sundance Festival that happened. Screen fell over. I do remember, I may be the oldest person in this room, I do remember when Earthquake came out starring Sir Charlton Heston.
Of course.
They had these sense-around.
Is that like smell-o-vision?
Made the seats vibrate.
Got it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For a terrible film.
John Cameron Mitchell, any closing thoughts on Nashville, snacks, movie theater disasters, or anything
I'd
else?
I'd say look at Charlton Heston again. We all know he was an idiot.
He was great in Bowling for Columbine.
That's right. But he had an authority, didn't he?
For sure. Oh, absolutely. He had a he had a very classic gravitas to him
did.
That was unmatched.
And he had a lot of lower teeth acting. And, you know, people forget that in The Omega Man, he played the last asshole on earth. So let that be the last film you watch.
John, thank you so much
You're
for
welcome.
Being on Movie Crush. Always a pleasure.
What a guy. John Cameron Mitchell, one of my favorite human beings in the whole wide world. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to know him and working together, and sitting down with him for this conversation was probably one of the coolest things I've ever gotten the chance to do. So really hope you enjoyed it. Chuck will be back for future interview episodes, and of course you can tune in to hear me and Chuck talk movies on the Mini Crush episodes. But hope you enjoyed this one. Thanks for giving me a shot, Chuck, to be in the big chair. It was a thrill. We'll see you next time, folks, on the next Movie Crush.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.